Do you have news fatigue? We continue our occasional series of conversations for people who are feeling overwhelmed with the recent barrage of breaking news by asking, what books can you turn to for escape? Two librarians across the state share their tips for both fiction and nonfiction books. And Etta James, Howling Wolf, and yes, Muddy Waters were all a product of the legendary Chess Record Studios in Chicago. The story of those blues legends are also the subject of a new novel by Renee Rosen.
I knew that Chess Records was the heart and soul of Chicago blues, and that was where I needed to start and tell the story.
Renee Rosen and Phil Chess's son, Terry Chess, join us to talk about her fictional novel and the true story behind Chess Records. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. The latest news is next. I'm a man. Yeah! Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Everything gonna be all right this morning. Now, when I was a young boy, at the age of 5, my mother said I'd be the greatest man alive. But now I'm a man, I made 21. I want you to believe me, honey, we're having lots of fun.
That's Mannish Boy by Muddy Waters off the legendary Chess record label. Chess Record Studios in Chicago was how the world discovered Muddy Waters, Etta James, other blues legends like Howling Wolf. And it's the subject of a new novel by Renee Rosen that's called Windy City Blues. The book came out last Friday, and the Chicago-based author is on the line with us now, as well as Terry Chess, who's the son of Phil Chess, co-founder of Chess Records. Renee, Terry, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me today.
Thanks for having us.
You know, I wanted to start by asking, you know, Renee, this isn't the first book about Chess Records. And of course, there's been movies. I'm thinking about Cadillac Records, and you're a historical fiction writer. So this is an interesting period for you to delve into. What was the motivation behind you writing this?
You know, I knew I wanted to do another book set in Chicago. My other novels have also been historical fiction set here in Chicago. And, you know, my editor and I were brainstorming, and we were, you know, trying to think of what is something that's so iconic Chicago, and of course the blues. And as soon as I started to research the blues, because frankly I didn't know that much about it, I knew that Chess Records was the heart and soul of Chicago blues, and that was where I needed to start and tell the story.
And at the end of the book, you list all the books and resources for the work that you did. I've always wondered, what goes into, when you're writing a historical fiction novel, what goes into that?
Well, in this case, I started with, you know, research, reading. There's so many, as you said, so many great nonfiction books about the blues. And then what I did was I went down to New Orleans, rented a car, and we drove the blues highway. And we stopped at juke joints along the way. We stopped at a plantation because I wanted to understand the sharecroppers and what life was like for them, because Muddy Waters, many of the bluesmen were sharecroppers. We went up to Memphis and, you know, went to all the museums up there. There's Stax and Sun Studios and the Civil Rights Museum, which was, you know, crucial to the research. So it was a combination of reading, hands-on, talking to people, meeting with people.
Yeah, it sounds like a lot of different research in there. And part of that also was talking to members of the Chess family. Terry, what was it like? How many members of your family ended up talking to Renee?
Well, my sister started talking to Renee, and then she had contacted me and asked if I would be interested in talking to her. And I said, sure. You know, and so my sister did, and I did, and my wife, Roberta, talked with her. And I think that's basically the three of us.
Your father, Phil, just passed away, actually, last fall. I'm sorry for your loss. I wanted to mention
Thanks.
It. Yeah. Did he know much about the book? Was that something, which is something that you, Ted, were able to talk to him about?
You know, he was very, what's the word I can use here? He had a brain injury many years ago from falling down the stairs. And he was pretty with it anyway, but there were certain things you just couldn't kind of communicate to, you know, with him about. And so this was something that I had mentioned to him, and he kind of gave me a blank stare, like, oh, really? And that was about it.
Go ahead, Renee.
At one point, when I first met Terry and Roberta, I had said, you know, guy, I would love to meet, you know, your father. And I just think that the timing just wasn't going to work at that time.
Sure.
But I so would have loved to have met him.
Yeah. And there's a lot of stories. I wonder how many stories from you guys, you all talking, Renee, you talking to the family. I'm sure they shared a lot with you. I wonder how many of them actually ended up in the book.
Well, you know, my first conversation with Pam really shed a lot of light on Leonard's character, his personality, and what drove him. And I write about this in the book, that there was a young girl that he had wanted to marry, and her father didn't feel that he was good enough for her. And that just lit a fire under Leonard Chess, and he was going to be a success no matter what. And that completely opened my understanding of who Leonard was. Terry and Roberta were telling me stories about how Phil was the one that took both Leonard's children and his own family down on these vacations to Florida, where they would stay at the Thunderbird. And I was charmed by that. And both the brothers were incredibly superstitious. And Terry shared with me, and Terry, you can probably explain this better, but there was a superstition around toenail clippings.
Oh, yeah, this is a very particular scene in the book. Can you, Terry, maybe you should share this story.
He liked to burn his toenails whenever he, you know, clipped them. And he put them in a neat little pile on the counter in the bathroom and set fire to them. And I used to walk by and say, you know, what are you doing? He said, well, I'm doing this so that when I'm dead, no one will walk on my grave. And I didn't know what to say to that. I said, okay.
Yeah, sort of chalking up to weird things that our parents do. I'm speaking with, and that's Terry Chess, son of the late Phil Chess, and Renee Rosen, who's the author of the new novel that just came out. It's called Windy City Blues. And Renee, at the heart of this are, of course, Phil and Leonard are main characters in the story, but the heart of the story is really a love story between two fictional characters. A Polish immigrant, is it Liba, is it Grotzky? Is that how, I'm
yep.
not sure. Okay.
Yeah.
And she works for the real-life Phil and Leonard Chess, and then a black musician named Red Dupree. Where did those two characters come from, and why did you choose to center the story around them?
Well, honestly, when I started writing the book, it was only told from Liba's point of view. And I got about 100 pages into the book, and I realized it wasn't working. And I backed up, and I started rewriting. I wrote another 75 pages. Still wasn't working. And it dawned on me that the story of the blues was far greater than one character's point of view could deliver, and that I really needed to have the authenticity of Leonard, because he was the first of the brothers who got involved in recording. So I needed to have that industry point of view and what happened from their vantage point. And then I also really needed to tell it from the bluesman's point of view, from the musicians that came up from the Delta. And that was where Red Dupree came along. And then I didn't really know that Liba and Red were going to fall in love. I mean, I had some inklings about it. But I didn't know that was where that story was going to go. And then, of course, you know, you've got a white Jewish woman with a black guitarist, musician, and we're talking about segregated Chicago in the 50s. So that opened up just a very natural avenue to have them be involved in the civil rights movement.
Right. And at the beginning of this book, there's a passage where Leonard says he doesn't, he sort of talks about the similarities between being black in Chicago in the 50s and being Jewish or in the 40s, talking about how he sees it as seeing African Americans part of the Great Migration coming up from the South by train. His family came by ship. Both of them came to seek a better life, and that white America didn't want either of them there, which is why he felt more comfortable in Chicago with people who were black than people who were white, but, you know, with the whole idea of being black or being Jewish in Chicago and everybody kind of converging on Maxwell Street in Chicago. Terry, I wanted to ask you about your dad and your uncle and if you were ever able to talk to your dad about that, about what it was like to be Jewish and work with so many black people, have that be so such a part of their story, whether it was Chess Records or later WVON.
My father was, he was a rather private guy in terms of letting me know about his feelings or his former life. And actually, there's a lot of things that I learned about my dad after reading Nadine Cohodes's biography of Chess Records, Spinning Blues into Gold. I never knew, for example, that they came over on the Mauritania. I never knew that he was a Golden Gloves fighter. Let me say this much: I never knew about a lot of areas of his life that he went through because he just didn't talk about it. And I'll give you a real good example. This is probably the best example that I can give you. When my dad was born, he was then they were Polish immigrants, as you know, and they were born. The whole family was born in a little town in Motel. It's called Motel, M-O-T-E-L-E, Poland. I used to call it Motel Poland, but it's Motel Poland.
Okay.
And it was a little village, and my grandfather, my dad's father, already had a couple of kids. He had Leonard and May, my dad's older sister. And he couldn't afford to raise another child in his mind. So when my dad was born, without telling my grandmother, he took my dad and he put my dad, newborn infant, into a little basket and put him in the river. There was a river nearby the village. It was kind of like Moses. And he figured somebody would, you know, come and pick the baby up and take care of it because he couldn't afford to do it. And he didn't tell my grandmother this. And the farmer who lived nearby happened to see this thing floating in the water and, you know, picked it up out of the water. It was my dad. And later on, he knocked on my grandfather's door and said, "Does this belong to you?"
Wow.
And, I mean, I never knew about this. And when I read about it in the book, I don't know how the heck Nadine Cohodes found out about it, but when I asked my mother about it, she said, "Oh, yeah, that didn't you know about that?" I said, "Well, no one ever told me." There was a lot of things that went on in my dad's life that I just never knew about. And so when I would talk to them about things, a long conversation with my father was like 2 minutes. I mean, he was a great dad. He spent a lot of time with us. Took me to a lot of, you know, ball games and played catch with me and did all the kinds of things.
He just didn't talk about himself, yeah.
No, and I mean, I learned all the stuff about him reading the book, and I think I attributed a lot of it to he was just a modest guy. In addition to being a private guy, he just didn't want people to talk. He just didn't want to be known by anybody, and that came up later in life. When people started coming up to him and asking for his autograph and, "Oh, you're Phil Chess," you know, he would look at me like...
Would he get embarrassed?
What? Yeah. He would give me kind of a sheepish grin, like, "What's the big deal?" And he never quite got it. He never quite understood why he was so revered by people in terms of the music history of the blues and so on. So... Yeah, I don't want to go on any longer.
No, that's okay. It must be strange to have all of these books about or movies about your family, about your dad and your uncle. Is it odd in a way?
Yeah. I mean, the first time it ever occurred to us that there was something different about my father and my uncle was in 1990 when they made it a Chicago landmark. And, you know, they made the studio a landmark, and they had a little ceremony. And I remember one of the columnists from the Chicago Daily News, now defunct, he went up to my dad and asked for his autograph. And my dad looked at me like, what? What does he want my autograph for? So that was the first inkling I had that it was different when they publicized the fact that it was a landmark. And then in 1997, I believe it was, when Hillary Clinton came, and she was first lady back then, to make it a national treasure, it really hit me like, wow. You know, I mean, it was me and Chuck Berry and Bo Diddley and my wife and my daughter as the reception line.
And then you just realized, right?
Yeah, I mean, and then all the books started coming out. And, you know, I grew up with all this stuff, and it never seemed to be anything unusual to me. It was just, that was the business my dad was in.
That's Phil Chess. I'm sorry, that's Terry Chess. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Terry Chess and with Renee Rosen, who's the author of a new book. It's just out. It's called Windy City Blues. It's a historical fiction account of the story of Terry's dad, Phil, his brother Leonard, Chess Records, a history of how this label helped start Chicago blues, actually blues for the world. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Howling Wolf, Smokestack Lightning, one of the many albums put out by Chess Records, which is the subject of a new historical fiction novel by Chicago-based author Renee Rosen. She's on the line with us from Chicago, along with Terry Chess, the son of the late Phil Chess, who's one of the co-founders of Chess Records. You know, right before the break, Renee, we were just talking to Terry about his dad, Phil, his brother Leonard, and you know, it strikes me at the beginning of the book, Leonard saying, talking about being Jewish and being black in Chicago in the 50s and how both of those groups were really excluded. And that's a really important part of the dynamic of this novel. I wonder how they all met on Maxwell Street in Chicago. And what was Maxwell Street, Chicago South Side, like in the 1940s?
We have to back up just a minute to say that, you know, around this time you had the Great Migration happening, where the blacks were coming up from the South, and at the same time you had a lot of Eastern European Jews coming over and emigrating to the United States, and a lot of them ended up in Chicago. And as you had said, people, it was not the most friendly place, whether you were Jewish or if you were African-American. So they came together on Maxwell Street, which was this open-air market. It was also, originally it was the Jewish ghetto. And as the Jews moved out into a nearby neighborhood known as Lawndale, the blacks came in and took over to live there, but the Jewish merchants still stayed there. And what happened was, in the Delta, you know, it was, people could play an acoustic guitar and a harmonica and be heard. But you come to Chicago, and you have the L, and you have all the noise of the people and the industry, and they realized that if they wanted their music to be heard, they had to plug in. And that's what gave birth to the electric blues, which was that Chicago blues sound. And what would happen is the merchants had their stores on Maxwell Street, And the musicians would pay the merchants, whether it was a quarter or a nickel or a dime, to plug their amp into their storefronts. And then they would go out there and play.
And you write about the clubs, the club that Leonard and Phil had, the clubs, the few clubs they were called black and tan clubs, the clubs that were integrated, because most of the clubs were segregated at that time.
You know, what would happen, like the Chess Brothers had the Macamba Lounge, and it was pretty rough. It was a rough bar in a rough area. And, you know, there would be a handful of whites that would go there because they loved the music, but it wasn't a common place for whites and blacks to mix. Those were strictly these black and tan clubs, and that was where no one was going to raise an eyebrow or a fist if an interracial couple got up and danced together.
And so they transitioned from the club to going into business, which eventually becomes Chess Records. And they have sort of this division of roles where Phil is the guy who's the social one, who likes talking to people. Leonard's the one who's the business guy, who just wants to run the business. Was that from sort of based in how you understood the brothers, the dynamic of the brothers were?
Yeah, well, actually what happened was because so much focus had been put on Leonard, that I assumed that Leonard was sort of the outgoing one of the brothers and the one that, was so welcoming to everyone. And what I found out, which surprised me, was the absolute opposite. Phil was actually the one that the musicians felt most comfortable with. Leonard was a little gruff, and, you know, Terry, you can speak to this certainly, you know, better than I can.
And also had kind of a foul mouth. Terry, is that true?
Oh yeah.
Well,
they both did. They can't say the words that they said every day. We cannot say on public radio.
Yeah, their favorite word was MF, you know, if you know what I mean. Their whole language was peppered with obscene words, you know, but when they used those words, it was done in a amiable, sentimental way to people they talked to. You know, if you weren't an MF, then you weren't friends with my dad or my uncle.
Yeah, there were terms of endearment.
Yeah, that's the word I was thinking of, terms of endearment.
And then the way that you describe, Renee, the way that you describe how these tracks are laid down, there's a scene when Muddy Waters records, "I can't be satisfied and I feel like going home." How much of that, was that how it happened with just these guys in a studio and they're just rolling and then they kind of get together and then they're riffing and then sometimes, you know, Leonard's yelling at them like, "You're not doing it right, you got to do it this way." Is that kind of how it all went down?
Leonard was tough on the musicians as a producer. He would beat them up to get that sound that he wanted, especially Etta James. He was really tough on her. When the very first time that Leonard heard Muddy Waters singing "I Can't Be Satisfied," as the story goes, he couldn't understand the lyrics. He didn't understand how it could just be a guitar and a bass. How does that make a song? And it was actually his business partner at the time, Evelyn Aaron, and this was in the Aristocrat days, which was the precursor to Chess Records, who said, "Wait a minute, we got something here." And then Leonard came around.
And the way that you describe all of this, too, of how it happened, how Leonard gets in his car and he goes down to the South and he's getting the records to be played. Of course, there's a lot of just casual slipping fives and tens and twenties to DJs to play a record, which, as we know now in music history, that pretty much was how it went down. When you said you took that trip, Renee, you kind of did the blues highway. What did you learn on that? Because there's a lot of in here, and it made me think about being a Jewish man going down into the South and Jim Crow laws. What did you think about when you were doing that?
Well, when I was down there, I was really, it was a feeling to sort of be down in the South because I'd never spent any time down there. And to get a lay of the land of where Clarksdale was in relation to Memphis and in relationship to New Orleans, and to be able to really absorb some of that, the feeling of the land down there. Everywhere we went, we passed people and they would say, "Hey, how y'all doing?" And it's just a, and, but they mean it, you know, they really want to know. So, you know, that was wonderful to get that feeling. And again, just the going into these juke joints was just amazing. We went to one in Zachary, Louisiana. It was Teddy's Juke Joint. And it's literally the guy's house. And you walk in, and there was a guy playing spoons on a washboard vest. You know, if you're hungry, his wife will go make you some food. It was just an amazing experience. And again, that was something I would never have been able to get out of doing research books or watching documentaries or anything like that.
Yeah, Terry, have you with your family? I mean, we were talking about before the break. You sort of like being around with Chuck Berry, and I'm just thinking about all of these names that are so legendary, in the whether it's Etta James or Muddy Waters or Chuck Berry, or I mean, was your childhood? I mean, did you just sort of grow up with all of us and just think this was kind of a normal thing?
Yeah, frankly, that's what I thought. I didn't really think about it as being, growing up with celebrities. At that time, I didn't even know that, you know, or consider them celebrities. They were just guys who made music for my dad. Chuck Berry. Used to stay at our house when he came in to record, and he was my roommate in my bedroom. He would put on his hairnet at night to keep it, you know, in order, and then he'd go to bed in the next bed over, and in the morning have scrambled eggs and coffee with my dad, and my sister and I would come down to the kitchen and sing for him. And he put up with it, best I could say. I remember visiting Bo Diddley's house in L.A. once when my dad was out there on a business trip, and Muddy Waters, you know, sitting around the office in my dad's sofa one day. And I asked him, what'd you do last night? And I can't say this for publication on the radio, but he said, I got lucky.
There's a lot of that in the book, too. Right? Particularly with Muddy Waters. I mean, you really can't make up kind of a lot of the, I feel like you, I mean, a lot of this, when you're doing historical fiction, there's a lot of elements of truth of Muddy Waters' very colorful life, lots of ladies that were there.
Mm-hmm.
And one question I wanted to ask you about, because I had never really heard this term before, Renee, and this is sort of the transition of, you know, as we're talking about this, I just think, Terry, sort of the role that your dad and your uncle with Chess Records played in bringing this music. I mean, originally, it was so segregated, and there was this term even, race music, which essentially, Renee, for you, that was really what they meant when they said black people were playing music, right?
Well, Race Records was black music for a black audience, and it became R&B. And, you know, I think the genius of what Leonard and Phil recognized was that there's a market for this. Nobody is marketing this music. They're not marketing it to a black audience or a white audience. And here we've got something that's going to appeal to both. We just have to market it. And they literally created that. And, you know, when Chuck Berry came on the scene, people hearing that record, they assumed he was a white singer.
Or like hearing Elvis Presley and thinking he was black, right?
Exactly. And, you know, suddenly they had crossed over. And all of a sudden you have these white teenagers who are defying their parents by listening to this R&B, this rock and roll. Suddenly with Chuck Berry and Maybelline, you've got a white audience tuning in and calling up and requesting they want more and more of this. And that is what started as Race Records became R&B, and that rolled into rock and roll.
And I think that also is sort of a natural segue in your book, where you include so much of the beginning of the civil rights movement, your character Liba, who, you know, and then is, you know, her family sort of disowns her, this Jewish woman, for marrying this black man. Sorry, I'm giving away part of the book for people who want to read it. Sorry, I won't give away any more after that. But there is, you know, they are involved in the civil rights movement, in the freedom riot and freedom rides. And that leads to, you know, eventually the brothers buying and creating WVON, sort of this voice of still today, such a voice of black, of sort of like the beginning of black radio in Chicago and the role that that played in the civil rights movement. Did you feel like, Renee, did you sort of just feel like all of this, you had to include that in the story as well?
No, you know what? It was such a gift from the writing gods because again, I don't want to give too much away, but having WVON be part of it was a big piece of the puzzle for me, and it sort of brought it all together.
So we won't give it away. We'll leave it for that, for everybody to read for the book. You know, I want to ask both of you what you think, and Renee, Terry, let's start with you. I mean, I wonder what we think you learn about music through a story, right? Because what do you think you learn about music by telling the story of Chess Records rather than, say, just the individual story of Muddy Waters or Chuck Berry or any of these, or both, you know, any of these individual musicians?
I think you know, it's such a broad stroke when you read the book, and it's I guess it defines how our culture evolved from just, you know, Patti Page and the four, you know, the Lettermen or the Four Freshmen, to become more of a I'm trying to think of the word, maybe a gritty, realistic sound. It just, music evolved from being just quite so pretty to be more rough and tumble. You would think it would be the opposite, that music would start being rough and tumble and evolve into being pretty. But with our music, with American culture, it started with the blues, started with the pretty stuff, like I said, the Patti Page and Four Freshmen kind of stuff, and just evolved into this really nitty-gritty, you know, raucous kind of stuff. And that's what I think you learn from the book, and I think it's a good thing that the music went that way, because the music before then was good, but to me it was, you know, if you look at it today with our perspective, it's kind of boring compared to what music turned out to be.
Yeah. Renee, is that what you're kind of hoping people get out of reading Windy City Blues?
You know, I fell so in love with the blues and the Chess story, and my hope is that people who maybe don't know that much about the blues will pick up this book and fall a little bit in love with it too. You know, what Terry was saying too, you know, we went from this nice, sweet music to music that is so infused with feeling and emotion and really reflected the times. And, you know, if people who would normally read historical fiction would pick this book up and say, wow, I had no idea. I didn't know about Muddy Waters or Howlin' Wolf or Little Walter. I didn't know all this music came out of Chicago. You know, there's songs that I could have sworn came out of Motown, and they actually came out of Chicago. You know, the Beatles, they have a Chicago presence. We played such a crucial role in laying the foundation for rock and roll. And I would love for people to understand that connection, understand the connection between the civil rights and the blues, and how it all evolved.
Renee Rosen, she's the author of Windy City Blues. It's just out now, as she said, a fictional account of Chicago history, blues history. Thanks for being with me, Renee.
Thanks so much.
I want to thank Terry Chess as well, son of the late Phil Chess, co-founder of Chess Records, for joining us and sharing a little bit about his family story as fictionalized in Windy City Blues. Thanks, Terry.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. With all the recent breaking news, some people are saying and maybe experiencing news fatigue, which is simply put feeling tired or overwhelmed and looking for an escape. Last week, we talked about books that can help you get informed and get equipped to sift through the news, especially when we're talking about digital chaff and all of the wheat there. But if you're looking, what about if you're looking for relief in the form of escape? If you want to curl up a book that will take you to another time or another world, we're continuing our conversation about how to deal with all of this by talking to two more librarians from across the state who are going to share their recommendations today for fiction and nonfiction books. On the line from Peoria and the Peoria Public Library is Robin Helfenthal. She's the manager of the Collection of Development Services. Robin, thanks for being with us.
Oh, you are very welcome.
Nanette Donahue is back with us. She is at the Champaign Public Library, where she's an assistant manager of adult services. Nanette, thanks for being here again.
Thanks for having me back.
First off, let me ask both of you. Robin, let's start with you. Do you get the sense now that there's an increased interest in books that are allowing people to escape? I imagine people are always coming into the library with that notion, but is it more pronounced now?
I think so. And a lot more audiobooks also we're finding that a lot of people are, you know, like listening to them while they're doing, you know, other things. But I really see in both nonfiction and fiction, it's kind of an equal number between the two of what we're seeing people come in and asking for.
Nanette, what about you?
I think reading has figured in a lot when people are talking about self-care. It's a way to get away from all of the things that are causing people stress, all of these outside stressors that you really can't control. So yeah, I do think there are a lot of people who are interested in more leisure reading, especially I've noticed in fiction. Genre fiction has been ever popular, and I think people are always looking for a good suggestion.
All right, so we're doing that. Let's start with fiction. And Robin, let's start with your first recommendation. This book is called A Gentleman in Moscow by Amor Towles. What's this about?
In 1922, Count Alexander, and I think it's Rostov, is deemed as a shameless aristocrat by the Bolshevik tribunal, and he's sentenced to house arrest in the Metropole, which is a grand hotel, which seems kind of interesting that they would put him, you know, under house arrest in a fancy hotel from the Kremlin. And the man has never worked a day in his life, and he now lives in an attic room while most of the tumultuous decades in Russian history are unfolding outside the hotel's doors. And it kind of ties a whole lot of things together. It's kind of like a mystery, and because there's secret compartments and special keys. There's duels, hidden assignations, stolen passports. I mean, it's just kind of a Casablanca-type drama, type fiction book.
Okay, so it sounds like fiction, mystery. Nanette, are lots of people coming in? I don't know. I feel like people who love mystery novels are very stuck on that genre, and they stay with that. Do you find that there are more people looking for a mystery now? What genres are you finding most popular?
Action adventure has been really popular. I think people are looking for things that are comfort reads, so gentle romance, gentle women's fiction. Really, it's a lot of different things. Mystery fans tend to be very serious readers, just like romance fans, and they will go through whole series in one fell swoop, and they want to read everything by an author.
Well, that's interesting. And so, Nanette, you chose, let's go to your first fiction pick, Crazy Rich Asians by Kevin Kwan. I didn't realize this was a trilogy. I read the first. So you have the Crazy Rich Asians trilogy. I read the first book. That came out a couple of years ago, right?
It did. It came out 2 or 3 years ago. And then the sequel, China Rich Girlfriend, came out about a year and a half ago. The next title in the series, which is called Rich People Problems, is going to be out in May. I'm actually reading a pre-publication edition of it, and it is a riot, just like the other two books in the series. It's about wealthy Asians living in Singapore.
I feel like is not the right word for this. Like, I think
ostentatiously wealthy
is probably the right word.
Yes,
for this,
like,
right?
Wealthy beyond our imagination, like dropping $9 million at a Chanel store in Paris is just nothing,
right? And then there's the one character who I love, who just has like an entire house where she just has a couture from all the collections, and she never wears them. She just buys them, and she has like this secret her husband doesn't even know, right? That mm-hmm. she has this like whole room.
And it just keeps getting more over the top. I'm in the middle of the third book now, and there's a redecorating of a house that is just so jaw-dropping. If you want escapist, this is purely escapist. It's drama. It's ostentatious wealth. It's a riot to read.
Yeah, that is. I didn't realize there was a second one. I need to check that one out. It's definitely a very fun book to read. Robin, when you're thinking about, I wonder, as you're listening to Nanette talk about people who are in specific genres, I wonder when the people are coming into the Peoria Public Library, are people looking for more escapist things? Is there a specific genre you're finding people being drawn to?
Mysteries are really very popular, and they want to read them like in order in the series. So a lot of times, though, a new book will come out, and they will see, oh, that looks really good. And then they'll find out that there's earlier books in the series, so then they want to start at the beginning and work their way through the whole series. And like I said, it is a comfort read to, you know, see the same characters and watch them, you know, build throughout a series of books.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. You're already familiar with the characters. You know their personality. Robin, Nanette, the next book you have on your list is Forbidden by Beverly Jenkins. What's that about?
I personally am a really unembarrassed fan of romance. And Beverly Jenkins' Forbidden is a romance. It's an Old West romance set in post-Civil War Nevada. Beverly Jenkins is an author of African-American romance, and her novels are very well known for having strong female characters who have a mind of their own and who are ready to seek their own fortune. And in this case, it's Eddie Carmichael, and she is moving from Denver to San Francisco to start her own restaurant. And she accepts a ride from the wrong person, ends up stranded in the desert in Nevada, when on his white horse...
Literally a white horse?
No, it's kind of figurative.
Okay.
Comes Ryan Fontaine, who is a pillar of his community. He's also biracial. He's passing for white. And he has built a life for himself in this city in Nevada. And, you know, he's...
Wow, this is very complex. This is more than your usual romance novel plot.
You know, and he's got a lot to think about if he falls in love with Eddie. He's already engaged to a white woman.
Of course, he's already engaged.
You know, if he falls in love with Eddie, he also has to admit to the community that he's biracial and risk losing the status that he's developed over the years.
Wow. Okay, so that's Forbidden by Beverly Jenkins. Now, Robin, let's talk about some nonfiction books. And I know that I think people kind of come down in different places how they feel about nonfiction. Robin, do you feel like there are sort of two sorts of readers, people who love reading nonfiction and people who think of it as their most fun, and then people who are like, oh, I'll take it or leave it?
It kind of depends on how the nonfiction book is written. Because some of them are very much written almost like fiction books. I mean, when you start to read them, and, you know, they're very, very, you know, suspenseful and interesting. And then you also have the ones that are more, I guess, for lack of a better term, dry. And those are the ones that, you know, people have a little bit more trouble, you know, getting into. But I think the three that I picked are ones that, you know, kind of have an interest for a lot of people in the times that we're in now.
Well, and certainly you picked Hidden Figures. This is Margot Lee Shetterly's book. The movie is based on the book. And Margot Lee Shetterly. Now, there were parts of the story that didn't make it into the movie. Robin, I bet lots of people are coming in and asking to see this.
Yes. And it really, is an interesting that in the fact that it also has come out as a young reader's edition, and besides the DVD and the adult, you know, version of the book. And what's interesting is, you know, these four women originally were teaching math in the South in the segregated public schools, but in World War II they were called into because of labor shortages, and so they all moved to Hampton, Virginia to work at the Langley Memorial Aeronautical Laboratory, which was very, you know, not an ordinary thing to happen in those times. And they also were, you know, they worked there through the Cold War, the Civil Rights Movement, and the space raid, and that's, you know, like 3 decades where they, you know, faced the challenges of the time. They made alliances, and they used their own intellect to change their own lives and also to change our country's future. which was really, you know, something for that time frame that they were working for NASA.
Nanette, are a lot of people asking about this book now in the Champaign Public Library also?
Yes, I think that the combination of the movie plus space plus African-American women making an impact is really hitting a lot of notes with people, and they're very excited about it. It's a fantastic movie, and the book is exceptionally good, too.
Is this one of those things, this is like a question I always want to ask librarians. To you, did you like the book better than the movie?
I really liked them both a lot.
Oh, you did?
I did.
Okay.
I loved the movie, and it was the movie that took me to the book.
Okay.
So
Robin, what about
first.
You? Have you seen the movie, Robin?
It was the same thing
the same
for
thing?
Me because
okay.
I really hadn't heard much about the book previously. But once I saw the movie, it was like, okay, now I want to go back and read the book.
Okay. Well, now everyone can, too. Hidden Figures, The American Dream and the Untold Story of the Black Women Mathematicians Who Helped Win the Space Race. Robin, you also picked The Book of Joy, Lasting Happiness in a Changing World by the Dalai Lama and Desmond Tutu. That's been out for a while.
It has been out for a while, and it's still really popular. We have a lot of holds on it, people wanting to read it. And I think I have a quote from it that I thought was really interesting because it says, "No dark fate determines the future. We do. Each day and each moment, we are able to create and recreate our lives and the very quality of the human life on our planet." And I thought it was really interesting that, you know, these two men got together to celebrate the Dalai Lama's 80th birthday. And out of that, you know, they shared their stories and their spiritual practices and, you know, and together, you know, they explored, you know, what true joy is, what obstacles there are to joy, you know, fear, stress, anger. And then they were able to come up with 8 pillars of joy. But you have to read the book to do that because they don't give that out ahead of time, and that would be kind of a spoiler to give you those beforehand. But it's a really interesting and I think a really important book at this point in time.
Yeah. Nanette, I wonder how many people are coming in looking for books like this also. Are you seeing?
We have a lot of interest in mindfulness, mindfulness books, mindfulness and meditation. We've done several displays on topics like this, and the books always go out like whoa. People have a real hunger for this. They have a real hunger for anything that's going to help them feel better about the world, feel better about themselves, feel more calm and relaxed.
And for both of you, obviously you're going to say reading anything is probably a good place to do that, right?
Absolutely.
Definitely.
So unfortunately, I don't think we had time to get to all of them, but we've got the list. We've got all of the books, as we always do with our reading lists. We'll tweet out the entire list. We'll have it at our website. So if you follow 21ST Show on Twitter, if you go to 21stshow.org, you can see these great reading lists that have been put together. I want to thank Robin Helfenthal from Peoria Public Library, Nanette Donahue from Champaign Public Library for coming up with these lists for us. Thanks, ladies.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
We've got a lot of reading to do this weekend. Thanks. That does it for us today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for the 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. And if you have Alexa, we're easy to find. Tell her, ask NPR One to play the 21st. All of those links, directions for Alexa, every other way to contact us, whether you want to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, follow us on social media, it's all at our website, 21stshow.org. If you follow us on Twitter, search for 21stshow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. And when we're not on air, you can follow us for the latest Illinois news. If you like us on Facebook, search for the 21st. You can comment on what we're working on, or you can post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. We're produced by Hala Delahi, Christine Herman, and Alan Montesilio. Abrar Alhiti is our intern. Technical direction comes from Jason Croft with help from Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Thanks to Joe Yoon and Nick Vance from the University of Illinois' Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help. And special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.